A few weeks ago, on the 21st of February, we got this message from ZachXBT in one of the Telegram groups. And the message said, currently monitoring suspicious outflows from Bybit of 1.46 billion will update as more information becomes available. Little did we know at the time that that would be the beginning of the biggest hack in history. And I think the biggest hack in crypto history for sure, but also maybe the biggest hack in history. It later emerged that the Lazarus Group, the North Korean Lazarus Group, may have stolen 400,000 plus ETH from one of the biggest crypto exchanges in the world, namely Bybit. Now, obviously, the next 24 to 48 hours in Bybit's life were very, very, very interesting. They tried to stabilize withdrawals. They tried to make sure that every customer got every single one of their deposits to avoid a bank run. And they did exactly that. In fact, as we all know, Bybit is alive and solvent and well and trading and probably survived one of the biggest bank runs in crypto history. Now the dust has settled, and after the dust settled, that gave people a little bit of time to actually look at what actually happened, what actually caused this hack. And today we're going to be looking at the forensics reports that happened, and we're going to determine exactly what happened, how this hack was caused. We probably can't change history, but what we can do is we can learn and we can apply the learnings so that the industry gets better and we have stronger security measures and that we actually share this info. So today, very special show. What we're going to do is we're going to look at exactly how this Bybit hack happened. And let me tell you, your mind is going to be absolutely, absolutely blown. Anyway, if that sounds good to you, what I need you to do, subscribe to the channel, obliterate the like button, and let's get this show on the road. You know, I wish I could say we're going to track the money and we can get the money back. But the truth is, the North Korean hackers have probably already laundered most of the money. And all we can do now is we can do a post-mortem to try to understand exactly what happened on that black day when Bybit actually moved the money. Right now, remember, at the time, what Bybit were trying to do is they were trying to move money from their cold wallet into what they call a warm wallet. And for those of you who don't know what that means, a cold wallet is usually a wallet that is very, very, very disconnected from the day-to-day operations of the exchange or the entity. And usually the security measures around a cold wallet are much, much, much stronger than those around a hot wallet. And typically, when hacks actually happen, they typically happen around the hot wallet where there's less security because there's more access to funds. But the interesting thing about this hack was that this hack actually happened to Bybit's cold wallet. And that is what allowed access to what is a huge amount of ETH, $1.5 billion worth of ETH. And the big questions are, well, how did the hacker actually get hold of a cold wallet? Now, I'm going to remind you that we did an interview with Ben, and how Ben described exactly what happened was he said, look, generally, they have a very specific group where they ask all the signers to sign the transaction. And in this case, there were four signers. Three signers signed the transaction. He signed the transaction as the fourth signer. All of these signers were in different parts of the world. And after he signed the transaction, he got the dreaded call from his financial director. And on that dreaded call, he spoke about how $1.4 billion had been drained out of the cold wallet. And now the big question is, well, how the hell did it happen? So to answer that question, I'm going to bring on two experts. Now, these are cybersecurity experts. These are the guys that actually generated the report that Ben spoke about, the forensic report that Ben actually spoke about, which actually breaks down exactly what happened. And I think the purpose of this is not to blame anyone, because I guess blame's not going to bring back the money, but really, really, really to understand exactly what happened and to understand what the hackers actually did so that as an industry, we can learn and we can become a whole lot smarter. So with that in mind, let me bring the guests on. I've got two guests with us. I've got Yoav Mazor. He's the head of incident response at Signia. And I've got Tan Nguyen, who's the founder of VeriChain. Gentlemen, welcome. So I want to ask you guys a question before we start. Just before this hack actually happened, were you guys actually working with Bybit? Were you guys already Bybit partners, or were you guys commissioned when this hack actually happened to actually try and unravel what happened? Yeah, I'm going to start with you, sir.
Okay, so we were actually engaged only after the incident, and we started working a day after on the 22nd.
And Tang, you guys?
Yeah, we also engaged with Bybit after the incident.
Okay, so you guys, you get a phone call from Bybit. Bybit say to you, listen, we've just had $1.4 billion stolen from our cold wallet. We need to determine exactly how this happened. I think before we actually get into the specifics of how this happened, Bybit mentioned that they use, for their ETH cold wallet, they use a provider which is called Safe, right? And Safe is effectively the industry standard in storing ETH in cold wallets, right? Can you guys just, for the purpose of people that don't understand exactly what Safe is and what Safe actually does, can you guys, Yoav, maybe you can explain to us, what is Safe and how do companies use Safe as a cold wallet solution?
So I can answer it shortly. I think Tan might be the more suitable to answer this question. As we understand, Safe is a platform to facilitate multi-signature transaction. As you mentioned, those transactions, they require three or four signers, so the transaction is approved. To facilitate it and to sign it, it requires quite a lot of smart contracts that are necessary, and this is what Safe is developing. Yeah. I think if we want to go more in depth, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, so Tan, please.
Tan, maybe you can just give us any other information that we need to know just to understand what Safe is.
So basically, Safe is a smart contract wallet. The one that Bybit is using is a kind of like multi-signature wallet that require like end signer to allow that transaction to be executed. So the logic of that is programmed into the smart contract on chains. So when you get enough of signatures, then the transaction will be executed.
So Safe actually just provide a smart contract software which requires multiple signatories to unlock or to pass a transaction. That's it. They're just a software company, right?
Yeah. So besides a smart contract, Safe also provide a front end. So the Safe user can use the front end to propose a transaction as well as to sign the transaction.
So I think just for the users who don't understand, it means that you can actually go to a front end which looks similar to this. This is not the front end, but you can go to a similar signing front end, or you can just go directly onto chain or onto the smart contract itself. So users, typically users that are not as sophisticated, can use an infrastructure's front end. But if you are more sophisticated, effectively you can bypass the front end and you can go directly onto the smart contract or onto the blockchain itself. So Bybit were using Safe to house at least, or we know of at least $1.4 billion worth of ETH, right? And you guys get a phone call, and on that phone call, Bybit tell you, listen, we don't know what's happened, but $1.4 billion worth of ETH out of our cold wallet has been stolen. What do you do? As a forensics company, maybe you can start this one. Where do you start? Like, you get this phone call. What do you do as a forensic investigator here?
So first of all, and I think this is important to necessary, the timelines of it, is we need to understand where we need to go. And in this case, it's to multiple places, as Bybit does not sit in one place. So we need to send teams to all over. And then we interview them to understand what they know so far. Based on this information, we do brainstorming to think of hypotheses of how this could have been done, what could have been executed, and then we try to look for either evidence to prove or to disprove those hypotheses.
Okay, so in this case, you get a phone call. They tell you that there were four signatories. Each of the signatories was in a different part of the world. They were all using specific laptops that they have, that they scrub regularly more than once a month to put through the transaction. And they all agreed that the transaction at the front end, at the face value of a transaction, looked like, following their protocols, that the ETH was routed from the Bybit cold wallet to the Bybit warm wallet, which is a normal transaction inside the course of business, right?
Exactly.
All right, Tang, what do you do at that point? Now you've got that information. What's your next point of call?
So like you are just share, right? So when we get a call, and basically the first thing we do is just look at the on-chain transaction, understand how it happened. Then from that, we will narrow down on what could be the possibility of the incident happen, right? And then we have to go on-site. In our case, we go to Bybit Dubai headquarters, and then talk to the Bybit team, the security team, understanding their operation process to narrow, and also look at like the area that we think that it potentially could be the place where we can narrow down and look for the root cause of the of the incident.
Okay, so just before you carry on, so the hack happens on a Friday night. How long after the hack did you get the call?
I think almost like right away, we got a call through one of our partners. We have the connect with Bybit to ask us to like, you know, join a room and try to understand what happened and try to help Bybit to investigate on what would be the root cause of the incident.
And are you guys now working together as a team, Verichains Insignia, or are you guys working completely independently?
We work independently.
Okay, so you're both working different paths to try and work out what's going on. All right, Yoav, walk me through what happens then. So you've now got this information, you've tracked the information, you know that they've all signed the transaction, you're seeing the money being laundered. What do you do then?
Exactly. So now what we understand, I think at that point, everybody, not only in the offices, but also people that are looking at least from X platform, we understand that there is a transaction that was signed. All the signers saw one transaction, and that there is a transaction, another transaction that is being executed. So it was safe to assume that there is manipulation that is done on the front end side. And for that, there was two main hypotheses. One is that it is coming from the server. The server is serving a malicious front-end, a malicious user interface. And the other hypothesis back then was that there is actually malwares on each one of the signer computer that is doing the manipulation on the computer itself. There are more hypotheses if we want to really go into what else can do that. But that was the main two hypotheses, and this is what we're trying to prove. Either find a malware or to find any evidence of the malicious code in the user interface itself.
Okay, so let's talk about the malware one first. The malware one, you would pretty much say, look, maybe there is a rogue Bybit employee, maybe someone sitting in the IT department, maybe there's someone working in Bybit that somehow managed to get bad software onto all four computers. And it is possible it's happened in multiple other organizations. But we do know also that Bybit does take precautions and they scrub their computers once a month. And that we know that these were very, very, very senior signers. But you cannot rule that out, right? So at this point, what you probably recommend is, guys, the four of you, do not sign any more transactions from your laptop until we know that your laptops are really, really, really clean. The server side is on safe side, right? And that is, you're talking around the front end of safe versus the internet service, not the internet service provider, but the server, basically. So it's between the server side and the front end of safe. How do you tackle that problem? Like, what do you do then?
So when we want to look at the front end, because it's a web interface, there is caching for this, for every front end that is being served by a web server, there is caching on the browser level. So one of the first analysis that was done was to look at those caches and to see if we really see if there are caches being created at the time of the signing. And if so, can we identify any malicious indication within those caches?
Okay. Tang, what happens at that point? So, I mean, I guess that you guys followed a very similar process, right?
Yeah, I think we are following the same process because there is only a few possibility of why it happened. So one is from the server side, the other one is on the client side. So definitely at that point, right, when we talk to the Bybit team, we try to understand the risk from both sides, as well as the first thing we look at in the machine is basically to look at the browser history, the cache file, and also looking for some sign of, you know, the compromise of the machines. So that's how we start, and that eventually and how we find out the root cause.
Okay, now walk me through, Tang, walk me through the process of how you actually discovered the root cause. So you've isolated that it could be the laptops, you've isolated that it could be the front end. Walk me through timelines and how you actually identified what actually happened.
Okay, so so I think that I arrived their office, Dubai office, on the like morning of Sunday, which is around like a day after the incident happened, because I need about 1 day for the visa to Dubai. So I think that in the morning, basically we talk to the team, understanding how they do operation, how the process of signing the transactions, where's the location of the machines that you signing and so on, right? Then after that, we get access into the machines. And I think that the first thing we look at is definitely is the browser, you know, like history and cache file. So I think that in the nights of Sundays, we managed to get access into the machines. So basically the issue is like, because there's the machines that basically having the evidence of the incident, right? And we have two or three forensic company working together. And so that's why we have to kind of like waiting for different company to look at the machines. So I think in the morning, on the next morning, when I start receiving the file from the machines, I think that right away after a few minutes, we figure out that there was a data inside the cache that's showing that it's likely coming out from the server side of Ceph. And then we try to figure out how that one can get modified or injected, right? Whether it's some man in the middle, where it's some certificate that installed on the machines, or whether it's actually come from the set server. So eventually we managed to find out from the cache version, right? The snapshot version of Wayback machines. And at that point, I think that we are, that one is actually the strong evidence that confirming that the issue maybe come from the external. That means it's come from the set server side, which is basically they use Amazon S3 to store the JavaScript payload.
So, okay, so Yoav, maybe you can explain to us exactly, because I mean, a lot of people watching the show are a little bit, you know, less technical. Maybe just explain to us step by step exactly what happened here.
So, on the entire investigation flow or the attack flow?
The attack flow. Let's talk about the attack flow.
Okay, so let me just share my screen quickly.
Okay, let me just get your screen up here. Okay, we're going to just get your screen up here. Okay, as soon as you share, just let us know and we'll get your screen up.
Okay, can you see my screen?
Yes, we can see your screen.
Okay, so if we look at the attack, and then we will discuss also how we managed to prove what I'm sharing now, is we see on February 19th, so 2 days prior to the transaction, the JavaScript resources, and the JavaScript is the actual, the front-end resources, were injected with this malicious code. So in web application, every time that you get the front-end, you pull it from the server. So we see that those front-end files are being injected with this malicious code on the 19th. And on the 21st, we see that Bybit really initiate this multi-signature transaction as they usually do in the regular process.
Can I just interrupt you? This malicious code, was it only injected in the JavaScript front end of the website that Bybit was pulling to sign transactions. In other words, not the generic one that anybody was using to sign transactions.
So it is the generic one for Safe. And this is one of the key points that when we will go into the code itself, while the code was sent to everybody, they have a specific condition there to only manipulate the transaction if it's Bybit's Gold Wallet.
Wow. Wow. And the reason why they did this was because they wanted to catch the big fish and they didn't want a small fish to ruin the big fish.
Exactly. So as we saw that the moment this happened, everybody is aware something is going on. Servers are being shut down. Investigation teams are on it. So you want to execute it on the biggest fish.
Okay, so what you're saying is 19th of February, this code happens. They very patient. Yeah. They wait 48 hours, knowing that Bybit more or less once a month puts through a transaction like this. Bybit puts through the transaction, and the code manipulates to say that to look like you're sending to one address, but in the back end, it's sending to another address. So it's actually like malicious code that allows the front end to look the same, but the front end is a mask for the back end.
Precisely.
Wow. Okay.
So we see this on the 21st, and as you can see here, in 2 and 11 minutes, there was the last signature, and then 2 minutes after, there is the execution of the malicious transaction when it was actually published, and 2 minutes after, the attackers restore the JavaScript files to the original version.
Holy
in
shit.
An attempt cover the evidence, the tracks, yes.
That is insane. Okay, now, the big question that I need to ask both of you is, how did the attackers get access to the JavaScript that controls Safe's front end? And I'm asking this because if Safe's only responsibility is to keep smart contracts safe, then surely they should have a protocol where nobody can adjust the JavaScript of their front end, no? Tang, how did this happen?
So I think that part is more on the safe side, so I cannot really say what exactly happened. But from the announcement from the safe, so they mentioned that it's one of their admin got targeted attack. So it's likely that the admin got compromised and they get access into their Amazon account, which he eventually able to modify the files host on their server.
So one of the, allegedly, one of the admins, one of the people that is allowed to change the Safe JavaScript somehow got hacked. And through the hack of his machine or her machine, they then used that to change the JavaScript code because this machine had access, one of the machines that actually had access to be able to change the JavaScript code, right? Okay, so now that brings us to a whole lot of questions. The first question is, first of all, what could Bybit have done different to avoid a hack like this? Yoav, I'm going to start with you.
So I think here there's some more conceptual question that we need to understand. It is not only Bybit, is
anybody.
This is the first type of attack that is a supply chain attack, which is something that we're familiar from other verticals and other industry in the cybersecurity world. But this is the first supply chain attack to such scale in the crypto industry. And to such scale, I'm not being picky on the specific number, but like a very big attack that is a supply chain attack. And I think this points to some lack of a golden standard comes to security in the entire crypto industry, as it's not regulated like traditional banking, but the money is there.
Okay, but so what you're saying is in traditional finance, are there regulations that regulate the entire supply chain? Like, in other words, if I'm dealing with a bank, is there a regulation that deals with me as a service provider to a bank?
Yes. If you are providing services, and especially if you're handling money of a bank, they will require a specific certificate, and there are very strict standards about it when it comes to traditional banking.
But in crypto, because the industry is not yet developed or regulated as much, you don't have the same services, and therefore, are you saying to me that in traditional banking, this kind of attack couldn't have happened?
I think it could have happened, but I think it's much harder. And I think it's, even when there is regulation, those type of threat actors and those type of attackers, they have the budget, they have the funding to bypass what is in the regulation. But for now, the crypto industry, as it is not regulated, the possibilities are much higher, and this is why this is the main focus.
So one of the things here you're saying, this is a supply chain attack, and this just shows that crypto companies, if they're using supply chains which are at any point vulnerable, then the company should do, number one, insist, but also do audits into their supply chain to make sure that the supply chain is really, really, really respecting the, in the lack of regulation, that the supply chain is really respecting the audits, which sounds kind of ludicrous in the absence of regulation, that every exchange would audit every service provider that they have. It just feels a little bit like, it just feels like a very long process, right?
Yes, it's a long process, and I think it also will slow down the fast pace of the industry. If we will put those golden standard and regulation in place, then the pace of development will not be as fast as we see it today.
Tang, what else do you think we could have done different here? So, like, I mean, Bybit, you're saying, could have audited Safe and could have had requirements in terms of what Safe could have done. What else could Bybit have done different, or what else could the industry have done different?
Can I share the screen? So if you look into this screen, I think that the timeline is very similar to what you are just sharing. Mm-hmm. But if you look into the logo and thing, right? So if you're talking about supply chain attack, so here you will see that their dependency from the Bybit side, right? So they use a Safe front end server and Safe using Amazon S3 to store the payload, and also inside Safe software, also there are multiple dependency on other component or library. And you look into that way, right? Supply chain attack is really hard to be able to detect as well as to fight against. So it's a long time problem, and not just in the crypto. So in the traditional banking, so I still remember that 7 and 8 years ago, I helped a bank to do incident response, right? So they're facing the same supply chain attack. So but basically that is, the switching gateway to authorize or the transaction.
Yes.
For example, like withdraw money from the ATM, right? So if you there's Lazarus and the North Korea team also, they do like, let's say, the fast card attacks and so on, again, traditional bank as well. So I think that the supply chain is always the big issue. And definitely, I think that in a way that to improve better, for example, in case of Bybit team, I think that there should be, more trick in the operation process, and you need to get some kind of better solution to size, transaction, to monitor the transaction, to do risk measurement with business rule to prevent the damage, right? And also in case of transaction involve, the very large amount of money, then it may require something more tricky. For example, you may want to have some kind of air gap system, some HSM or whatever, to be able to make it more secure and harder to be attacked.
But can you do an air gap system on ETH where you're dealing with smart contracts? I know with Bitcoin you can do air gap system, but on ETH you're dealing with smart contracts. So can you do air gapped on ETH?
In this case, yes, you can do that, because the signing part can be done offline, And you only need to bring the signature after you sign in. So yes, it can be done in AirGap system.
So I want to ask you a question. I saw this tweet, which came out just after the attack. And I wonder how true this is. It says, in light of the incident at Radiant and clear challenges verifying multi-signature transaction on LedgerDevice, I built a simple bash script designed to simplify the process. The script generates a domain, message, and safe transaction hashes, making it easy to cross-check them with the values displayed on your Ledger hardware wallet. All you need to do is provide the network name, multi-sig address, and transaction nonce. It supports all safe networks, and I hope it will serve as a tool to temporarily do this. Would something like this have helped, or would this not have helped that kind of attack? Because you'd have the same transaction nonce with, I don't know, I mean, would any of this have potentially worked?
I think the simple answer is yes, but what we need to remember is that this vector happened once, and they put effort to build this vector. And once we cover specifics around the vector, they will find a way to do another vector. So we can always look backward and see, okay, we could do this small thing that will prevent this exact execution, but then there will be another way, and the approach should be more safe as a general and not just like,
So question, how sophisticated were these hackers, honestly? Because you say you've seen this kind of attack before. Like, is this, if you take 10 being the most complicated hack that you've ever seen in your hacking life, and one being hacking someone's, you know, password on their iPhone, how sophisticated are these hackers relative to real hacks out there? Like, be honest. Like, I know we're crypto people and we want to think that, how good were these hackers?
I would say very good. Very good. And we can break it down to why I'm saying it.
Okay.
If we look at this hack, there's several, and I'm basing it based on what we have in our investigation and the limited information that we have from the public announcement from SAFE. But we know there is a developer computer involved. We know there is AWS or Amazon Cloud Infrastructure. And then the application itself and the code that was injected was application specific. And then the signing process. And then also in the blockchain and the laundering. So all of those are components that you need to tackle and you need to make sure you have the abilities. So when you look at those, and we didn't even say how was the developer's computer was compromised, likely social engineering. So all of those phases must have a vector and a tool that some of it is developed specifically for this hack, and some of it is developed by the Lazarus Group over the years. So they have quite a vast amount of tools in this tool set to be able to execute this vector end to end. Compared to, and now I'm getting us to the cybersecurity space. So the other very common attack that we see now is the ransomware case. So in the ransomware case, usually there is a zero-day exploit that they take from a available, and then IT capabilities. So the level that they need to, the amount of steps that they need to take is much more than a typical hack or the usual hack as you phrased it.
Give me a number out of 10, like out of the best hackers you've seen, like the ultimate hack is a 10. Where do you put these guys?
I would put it on the 8+.
Tang, what do you think? Like, how do you rate these hackers?
So you think about this, right? So they are state sponsor hacker and they have finance motivations. They make $1 million every year. So you know that they are going to be very good. So I think that 8, 9+.
Okay, what do we do? What do we do?
So it's not about the technical skill sets. It's about how well organized they do, right? So that's more important.
You know, I feel so vulnerable right now. I can't even tell you. I'm sitting here and I'm going, holy shit, if these guys looked at me, like, bro, they would steal photos off my phone in 20 seconds flat. Okay, what do we do? Okay, we've been hacked. We've lost $1.5 billion. The hackers laundered all the funds. What is your message to the industry? What do we need to do better? How do we avoid this shit happening? You've said one thing, which is supply chain verification and regulation of supply chain. And maybe basically what you're saying is if you're going to use someone in such a critical part of your supply chain, they may as well be integrated into the security protocols of your business, right? That's probably what I think what you've said as number one. What else as an industry do we need to do to avoid this shit happening again? Because I don't know about you guys, my heart can't take another one of these. It can't take another one of these Friday nights. So what else can we do?
So my main message that I would like to say is that sharing the information and helping others protect, once we see this vector, now there's all those solutions on how to stop this vector. So we need to share this information so people can start building those and we can implement it cross industry. I've seen multiple cases of crypto exchanges and crypto in the crypto industry, and a lot of it had similar components. If there was more transparent of all the victims, then other victims could have been prevented.
Okay. So sharing information, we will share information. This attack vector is closed now, right? Like, I mean, Lightning ain't going to strike the same place twice, I hope. I mean, I hope that Lightning ain't going to strike the same place twice.
So, as I mentioned, there's multiple stages to this attack.
Yes.
I think maybe one or two of them is closed, but then we need to make sure that the rest is closed. I can share that social engineering is definitely not closed.
Yes.
And the capabilities on AWS is definitely not closed. So we might see variation, and maybe it's not going to be safe. It's going to be one of the companies that is executing safe. And then is it the same vector? Not precisely, but we can improve more than that.
Okay. I mean, I guess another thing is not to keep as much money in one wallet, like $1.4 billion in one wallet just sounds like, why don't you have three wallets and each one of them with $500 million? And that's enough. Like, at least then if your wallet gets hit, then it's only one of your wallets, right? Like, that to me is pretty, I think that to me is something that really, really, really stuck out. Is like, why do you have $1.5 billion in one wallet? It's so easy to get another wallet. What do you think of that, Tang?
So on that one, it's basically, you know, like many crypto projects, especially exchange, so they are keeping money of user. It's not, I mean, it's basically it's like a bank that they keep a lot of money. So I think that in common sense, you should apply whatever, you know, like risk measurement, business rule, and so on, which apply to that. So for example, you don't keep like so many money in one place, and you have multiple, you know, like checkpoint and security control around that. And for example, supply chain attack, you only can use like multiple different solutions. For example, if you sign a transaction, you only can use like different front end, different UI to sign a transaction to avoid, you know, like single point of trust, like the incident just happened. And then you can only do some advanced signature, as let's say air gap or offline. So it's also help to reduce the attack surface, and it make it harder. It doesn't mean it cannot be happen, but it's make a lot more harder, right? Mm. So and also there's multiple of like custody solution that using, you know, like threshold signatures, MPC and so on, that kind of thing you can apply into like some less, you know, critical wallet, like the hot wallet, for example, which might used to be actually implement a number of different, you know, rules which need to be checked before the node actually signed a transaction. So you think about this, right? The bank also keep billions of dollars, but and they can be get hacked as well. It's happened multiple times, but they're not going to lose a lot of money.
Because you're right? getting back from another bank, because all the banks are connected, because banks don't settle immediately. Banks settle sometimes T plus 30. So you can't really compare, right. which is why banking, I mean, crypto is so much better for the hackers, because once there's finality on the transaction and there's enough signatories in the transaction and confirmations, then it's finished, it's gone. And that's why I think that crypto is much more vulnerable than bank. You can't even compare this to banking, because even if this happened in banking, some bank would phone some other bank and somewhere the ledger would be stopped and reversed, and that would be the end of that hack, right? I mean, there's no way you could go and draw $1.5 billion from any bank anywhere within 20 minutes.
True, but then with smart contract and so on, I'm not specifically this case, because in this case that the SEP wallet contract is operable. So basically whatever logic that you put it there can be bypassed as well. But then if you have the smart contract wallet, you always can add like the future, like you want to delay the transaction, you want to have additional verifications. For multisig, you only can do like signing, like each of the signing need to do it on chain. So let's say if you have three signers, you need to submit that three signing, on chain as well. So you have some time to verify and review that. You can add policy that if there is some amount is too big, it's not allowed to make it happen. Or if you want to delay the transaction or require additional verification. So that those kind of thing can be done in smart contract, just to make sure that the smart contract is not operable by some key like this case. But yes, there are multiple ways that you can improve the security. There's nothing that 100% secure, but at least you have a way to, limit the damage as well as to reduce the chance that you're going to get hacked.
Amazing. Guys, listen, first of all, congratulations on really amazing work. I mean, to be called in after the incident, and you guys acted really, really fast. You guys had your reports out in no time. First of all, congratulations. Second of all, if people want to get hold of you, where can they get hold of you in case, maybe other exchanges are going through similar incidents, will go, hopefully not, but maybe it'll happen. What's the best place to get hold of you, Av?
So the best place is our website, signia.co. We have a button there, I'm under attack, and then it will get to our hotline and someone will answer immediately.
Amazing. And Tang, what's the best place for people to get hold of you?
Yeah, that should be our website as well. Like Signia, we have been doing and helping a lot of hack, especially in the crypto.
We will leave the original websites to both. Just Tang, just so we know, what is your website? Is it verychange.io? Verychange.io and signia.co, right? That's right. For I don't want to send people to a malicious front end. That would be the worst thing that I could do here right now. Guys, thank you very much. Congratulations on the amazing work that you've done. Thank you for making crypto a little bit safer. I'm just upset that the price tag of making crypto a bit safer here was $1.5 billion. But I guess as an industry, we learn and we get better and we get stronger only because we get hacked. And someone actually asked me and they said, would you rather put your funds on an exchange that has been hacked or an exchange that hasn't been hacked? And I'd say 10 out of 10 times, I'd rather put my funds on an exchange that has been hacked because they understand the pain of getting hacked and they also understand to fill in all the processes. And so I'm glad Bybit survived this. I'm glad that I guess we can say that the vector of attack was not really a Bybit one. Although now from what you've said, we kind of realize that maybe they could have had a few more rules just to not have too many, not allow $1.4 billion of transactions in one batch and. But I guess that all of this is now being dealt with. So guys, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for a very comprehensive report. And thank you for keeping us a little bit safer in crypto. And to you guys and the Banter fam, listen, if that didn't shock you, I don't know what will shock you. And to me, it's just a reminder that we need to be, we're dealing with crypto. And once, transactions happen, they can't be reversed. And because that's the case and because the transactions can't be reversed, we need to make sure that we really, really, really are vigilant about protecting ourselves. And yeah, there's a couple of rules that I would definitely recommend. The first thing is, as much as we like our centralized exchanges like Bybit and Binance and all of them, you don't need to keep a lot of your money on centralized exchanges. Spread your money over a lot of wallets. Have some money on centralized exchanges. That's like your hot wallet. That's the money that you need to trade. But the rest of the stuff, keep on cold wallets, which are not connected to the internet and are not software wallets. The second thing is, get yourself a cold wallet. There is a link below to Ledger wallets. Get yourself a Ledger wallet and keep your money off exchanges onto a Ledger wallet. The third thing that I would do is I would definitely have a VPN. That just masks your IP address and makes sure that people cannot see what location you are in. And that is one thing that I would do. And the last thing that I would do, and one that I take very, very, very personally, is one of the things that we have in crypto, one of the biggest problems that we have in crypto is we have these things called drainer front ends. And what these front ends look like, exactly like the other front end was manipulated. The front end looks like a normal front end. But when you click it and when you interact with it, it has a drainer code that is designed to drain your wallet. Now, there may be other services, but I'm only aware of one service called Kerberos. And what this does is it doesn't work off a blacklist of malicious sites, but it actually scans the site's code in real time. And using the site's code, it realizes whether or not this site has drainer software. This service, they don't charge you a subscription, but they do take a very small trading fee on some DEXs. You add this as a Chrome extension, and literally, if you land up on a malicious site which is about to drain your wallet, it will stop you from making the transaction. Once again, I'm leaving the links below. There's a Ledger link, there's a NordVPN link, and there is a link to Kerberos. Guys, protect yourselves, because once the money is out of your wallets, it's gone. And there's just no way to get it back. If Bybit's not getting their money back, I can assure you that if you get hacked, you ain't getting your money back. I'll see you guys again on Monday. Until then, stay safe, my friends.